Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Born into a famous winemaking family in Tuscany, Piero Incisa della Rocchetta had a brief spell as a banker in Geneva before he dedicated himself to his first love, Pinot Noir. At Bodega Chacra in Patagonia, he's made some of the finest examples of the variety in the New World, as well as a pair of brilliant Chardonnays with the Burgundian guru Jean-Marc Rouleau, using biodynamic, low-intervention methods to get the best out of a great terroir. Hello, Piero, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tim. Good to see you.
Great to see you, and I know, lucky man, you're in Patagonia right now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in Patagonia. We're done with the harvest. Everything is in élevage right now. And so, yes, it froze last night, so we woke up with a nice gentle frost. So, you know, we fight it with water systems. All the boys were up from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. And we managed to save the nurseries and all of the new plants. So far, so good.
I mean, we'll talk about this later, about what a difficult place it is to make wine. It, you know, really is the edge of the world. But let's begin with a little bit about you, because you were born and brought up mostly in Tuscany. But I think your family, which is the Incisa della Rocchetta family, was originally from Piedmont. Goes back to what, the 11th century records, or maybe a bit older, is it?
You know, there is a lot of old families in Italy. Yes, Incisa della Rocchetta is our last name from my paternal grandfather, who was Piedmontese, but he was also half Roman, son of a military family, and his mom was from Rome, a Roman lady. This history of the family dates back a long time. Sometimes there was more prestigious tales than others. But on some level, they've always been warriors and farmers. And also they were working a lot on vineyards. As a matter of fact, I'm reading a book right now about a very famous Italian industrialist, a book that referenced a life in the 1800s. And they were already talking about Incisa della Rocchetta with his vineyards. But then, of course, you know, there was a long gap. And the wine was reignited by my grandfather in the early 40s. So there was a gap between the 11th century and today, you know.
But you often talk about your grandfather, incredible person, right? The Marchese Mario Incisa della Rocchetta, who created Sassicaia, one of Italy's most celebrated reds, really. He seemed like a very formative influence on your life. Just tell us a bit about him and what you learned from him, both as a person and also about wine.
First of all, I had the privilege to almost be raised by my grandparents. Mm-hmm. I went to boarding school in Switzerland, and we had a house in the mountains and one in the city, and they came to visit us, and they stayed in Switzerland for long stretches of time. And then I spent my summers in Bulgari, where they reside, and I lived in their house with some of my cousins. It's really a privilege to be in that formative age, to be surrounded by older people. He was an incredibly intelligent man, way ahead of his times. He already had created a bird sanctuary. He was the first president of WWF in Italy. He also was a horseman. When he was alive until his death, we won pretty much every single horse on the planet. He won the Arc de Triomphe back to back. One of his horses, called Rebo, was considered the athlete of the century. This came out, I think, a couple of years ago. So he was a little bit a jack of all trades, a Renaissance man. You know, he was an architect. He was a farmer. He was a writer. He published a couple of books. One of them is still in the curriculum of the University of Pisa. So he was a person that always was very intelligent, disposed of the superfluous, took care of the community around him, Frankly, a very illuminating person on all aspects, and really a steward of the land. And so what am I today? It's nothing but in an unconscious level, most likely, and some on a conscious level. I'm just repeating what I've observed in a younger life. I think this is one of the things that most people don't talk about. It's the privilege of being surrounded in your formative years by responsible, engaged adults. And so it was really a blessing. Does it make sense what I'm saying to you?
You struck lucky, didn't you? Did he introduce you to wine as well? I mean, did you drink wine with him?
He introduced us to wine, myself and my cousins, in those Italian households. We always had a bottle of red and a bottle of white. He was a wine lover. Incidentally, he was not a particularly fond of Sangiovese, which is odd considering that he moved to Tuscany with my grandmother, hence the first planting of the Sassicaia vineyard. There was always wine on the table. He taught me very early when you want to buy a wine from a great domain, but from a bad vintage. The wine will be half its price and you'll be able to drink it early. And great domain have a great terroir, so they'll make an extra effort to make good wines.
And that's still good advice, isn't it?
You know, in those days, wines were around 11.5%, 12% of alcohol. Bordeaux was called claret for the most part. So I guess that the privilege is a discovery. You're mentored by a person that is 60, 70, 80 years old, older than you, and you leapfrog a lot of things that you're not aware of, but they come into your consciousness later on in life. So you ponder from time to time, this came from there. And again, what a luck to have experienced all of that.
Definitely.
So typically we had some Burgundy, sometime Bordeaux. And so I fell in the soup as a kid, if you can say it that way. You know, like there is a comic book in France called Asterix.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit like Obelix. I'm a little bit thinner, but
yeah.
Yes.
and I mean, did you ever think of becoming a winemaker when you were growing up? Because your first job, I think, after you left school was as a banker. I was surprised to learn. I mean, it doesn't seem very like you at all. What happened there?
Well, no, nobody's perfect, Tim. I joined the dark force before seeing the light. I wanted to be independent. My goal was to get a job. I got to work for a Swiss bank a week after I graduated from my baccalaureate, my French baccalaureate in Switzerland, and I wanted to be independent. I wanted to strike on my own. And after a couple of years, my father called me and he said, "I think you should go to university. You have ample time to work in life. You've been in Switzerland for a long time. Why don't you go to California?" Imagine, this is the best advice my father ever gave me. I don't know which other father would say this to their son. You know, typically it's like an Ivy League school or something. And so I moved to California. After that, I went to college. I did Pepperdine University, and then I graduated from there. And then I did my master's in New York. And then I started to work in the family business.
But you were studying what, economics, weren't you, rather than winemaking?
Yes, because even though it was very clear to me that I didn't want it to be a banker, hedge funds were not in fashion, and maybe they didn't even exist back then, considering that I'm 56 years old. But, you know, you get to make all this money, which at that age is great. And then on the weekend, you go to a club, you blow them off, all of them, in liquor, because you're young and not particularly smart. And then coming Monday at 7:30, you're back in the bank. And a day, I woke up and I thought, what am I doing? This is not the life that I envisioned for myself. And so I took my father's advice. I left and I went to California, which was one of the best decisions of my life, because really California.
Yeah, who doesn't want to live in California as a young man, right?
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you that because I went to boarding school and I lived in Italy before, I had no idea what California meant. Zero. I didn't know about Hollywood. I didn't know about the music business. I know about surfing. And I thought that by moving to Malibu, it would look like Turks and Caicos. In reality, I showed up in Malibu, it looked like a Tuscan beach, exactly the same. And I remember I was in the dorms looking at the window. There's deers coming, eating from olive branches next to my window. And I'm like, this is like being at home. It's the same aromas, the same flavors, the same smells. No, California was a formative experience for me. Yeah. It was.
I mean, do you think the fact that you didn't train as a winemaker or viticulturist, has that helped you in a way? Do you think it's sort of allowed you to follow your own path? Has it freed you up in a way?
Ignorance is bliss. You know, I think that for any kind of industry, when you're trained, you learn a lot of things, but also you're in a box. You have paraocchi, as we say in Italy, which are those little things that they put on horses. I'm not sure what the word in English is.
Blinkers.
So yeah. When you go to any university or school, they put blinkers on you. They need to squeeze you within a format. And that, I think, really diminishes the avenues that you could take. Mm. It really diminishes your creativity, and it doesn't allow for alternative thinking and then considering other options out of the box. I think this is true for wine or for anything else. Engineers have a tendency to over-engineer everything and to do a lot of useless things, for instance. And to a certain extent, you see that in big pharma or in doctors today as well. So I think that the advantage is that if you come in with a lot of curiosity, innocence, and a good dose of naivete, and also maybe of masochism, because you're going into a situation in which you don't know anything, and yet you still do it. So I think that all these elements coupled together are I see it as an advantage, not as a setback. Of course, Tim, I surround myself with people that know a lot more than me constantly. The people that work for me are far better than me. And this is a great help, because also I don't believe in being, there is no protagonism when you work at Chakra, but in nature, we work as a team. And as a team, we're so much stronger. So I think it's when you're not, don't receive a formal training. I think there is a lot of pluses as long as you're aware that you don't know what you don't know.
I think that's very true. Yeah.
And you keep your ego in check. And you listen to other people, not to give them your opinion, but really to listen to their opinion. Because often we listen to other people, but while we're listening, we're preparing our answers. We're never really listening, so we don't have a real follow-up question, because we're more busy saying whatever the heck we want to say. And sometimes that just comes from, I don't know, childhood trauma, because you didn't feel acknowledged. So, I don't know. But
tell us about Pinot Noir, because you kind of fell in love with Pinot Noir and you decided you want to make it, didn't you? How did you end up in Patagonia? Because I think you considered all sorts of places, didn't you, first?
Well, Tim, femme fatale, how could you not consider Pinot Noir? I just told you I was a little bit of a masochist. If you lived in Burgundy and you owned a few hectares in Côte d'Ivoire, you wouldn't be a masochist. But if you come to Patagonia for that quest, certainly indicates, a lack of consciousness or just, I don't know. Listen, I tried Pinot when I was a kid. And what I appreciated about it was his gentleness, his softness, it's just, the king of all grapes or the queen of all grapes, because it also makes you experiences things that touches you on so many different levels of vibration in your body. It touches your brain, your creativity, your heart, but also your chest. It's a vibration that comes through you, and it's sort of transformative. I had that with other cépages as well, but maybe Pinot was the strongest one that I experienced. And so while I decided to strike out on my own after I worked for Tenuta San Guido, my family's estate, for close to 20 years, I wanted to be on my own. I wanted to apply all of my ideas. I believe that it was imperative that someone try to do on a scalable level a chemical-free wine. Now, chemical-free wine, let me expand. Of course, in every wine, there might be some chemicals, whether it's sulfurs or anything else, and so in the vineyard. But I didn't understand how the world, even at a smaller level, was still using massive amount of chemicals, which de facto killed all your flora and sometimes your fauna as well. And so it diminishes the vibration of the terroir, which in in as a repercussion makes you use a lot of chemicals to stabilize wines or make them fresher or whatever. I felt that all of this could be done with a natural intervention. I have the same philosophy for myself. I don't go to a doctor. I don't take medicines. And I wash my hair with vinegar. I brush my teeth with like soda and coconut oil, you know, like old school remedies. So I imagined that was a possibility. And so I start looking for vineyards. I was in Oregon. I was in California. I went to Burgundy. I realized Burgundy was mission impossible because it's very protected. Very few things are up for sale. And the few things that are up for sale, they're very small. Then it's difficult to find room to build a winery. It was almost impossible to assemble 20 or 15 hectares because it's a model that works. If it's any smaller, it doesn't make any financial sense because it's good to have passion, but you know, your numbers have to be solid. Otherwise it's really sheer masochism going through a wall or towards a wall. And Oregon and California seem to be the two areas that were most palatable. In light of a growing, flourishing wine industry and a very strong market, because it's the seventh largest economy in the world. I believe that when you do something new like this, you have to consider that all factors, not just terroir and grapes and climate, but you have to broaden it, because I felt that I only had one chance and I didn't want it to fail. And so I needed to take my exercise of quantifying all the unquantifiable and the intangible, because knowing I had one shot, it had to be, you know, done with a certain thought process.
Sorry to interrupt you, but why only one shot? Was that because of who you were, in a sense? You know, you're from this famous winemaking
family.
This
is my own insecurity, yeah. Tim. It's my insecurities and everything that stems maybe from other things, you know, and I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I knew enough. I was very well aware that the control is not something that you can have in this business, because nature has at least 50% of the equation. And all these factors put together with a generous amount of fear and insecurities maybe gave me, restricted my vision in thinking that I was going to get this chance once.
And you tasted this wine, didn't you? Which was I think it was a Canale wine, wasn't it? H Canale wine, wasn't it?
Yeah,
was I went it H to Canale.
The Wine Spectator. And then my cousin Noemi, who used to own Argiano, she invited us for dinner. And I remember there was a bunch of people, a bunch of wine critics, other producers. Some super illustrious, some less illustrious, and wines were blind. And one of the blinds served was a delicious Pinot Noir, which per se was nothing insane, but it was pretty. It was floral. It was elegant, like a little Bolshoi ballerina. Of course, then it didn't have enough structure. Like, you can see a lot of good things in a bad wine. I'm not saying this was a bad wine. This was a okay wine, but in that moment, it drank great. And it has this drinkability and this sapidness, this salinity, that I thought, where is this? So they uncovered the bottle. It was from Patagonia. I thought Patagonia was a brand of clothes and the land of glaciers. This was my ignorance about South America. And so I called Noemi, because for 3 weeks I couldn't get this wine out of my head. I constantly thought about those profiles and flavors, La Femme Fatale, as I told you before. So I took a plane. I came down here foolishly, not knowing how to speak the language. And I start looking. I helped her in the cellar with her partner, Hans, because they started a little venture here called Noemia, in which they're making Malbec. So something completely radically different from what we do. And during the weekend, I was looking for a farm. And I eventually found this abandoned vineyards. I don't know how, because all the roads here are dirt roads. There was no cell phones. There was no communication. They were handwritten maps. And
was this Señor Piri, was it? This was the 32 vineyard, the 1932
vineyard?
This was
the 32 vineyard, and when I saw it for the first time, it had weeds that covered most of the vineyard. And then I pushed the weeds aside, the perfectly grapes underneath. I thought, how can these grapes be perfect? It should be like oidium everywhere. And then like, nothing made sense. First of all, you're from the plain, and like, okay, this is a gigantic mistake. This is a desert. What am I doing? Pinot in the desert? Are you kidding me?
But who planted it? Do we know? I mean, was it Senor Pili?
I know that I don't know a lot of things, but I should have known a little bit better before coming here because the terrain is really crap. And what the hell? This is a gigantic waste of my time. And then a whole world opens up to you. You know, we don't know what we don't know. And we have this arrogance it's cool. Everything gets put in a box, and whatever diverse from that box, you just never consider as a possibility. Turns out that this is a desert. So you have an incredible luminosity, which gives you a perfect ripening of the grapes. You have a constant wind that dries, if there is any rain, it dries everything up and removes pest, disease, and bacteria. You don't have phylloxera, at least if we do, it doesn't propagate. So all the vineyards are Franco di Piede, ungrafted, Massal selection. We don't have clones. And then you have a soil composition that my buddy Pedro Parra, who's the geologist of Chakra, calls it an atomic terroir that sits over the vomit of the Andes. He always has pretty words followed by not so pretty words.
Yeah, but I still want to know who planted the vineyard, though. Who planted it in the 30s? Who was mad enough to plant Pinot?
Yeah, mad or just didn't happen. You know, you used to send a telex to Europe. They send you whatever they hand. And when you receive the grapes, forget about it. It's too late. What are you going to do? Sue them?
They thought it might have been something else.
Yeah. So the little interesting aspect of the story is that these vineyards have always been farmed by Italians. Yeah. They were planted by the Napoletano brothers. I assume they were from Naples, hence Napoletano. And then they were purchased by Pirri. So from Naples, they went to a gentleman that is from the north. Mm. And then Mr. Pirri sold it to me. So I am the third owners of these vineyards, and they've always been in Italian hands. Yeah.
What a great story.
I'm not planning to sell, so.
Yeah. Is he still alive? Is Signor Pirri or not?
Is it what?
Is he still alive? Is he still with us?
No, the scene was like a scene from the Marlon Brando movie. He asked, where is Dr. Pirri? They show me one direction. I get out of the car to open the gate. There's a couple of super tiny, loud dogs that are trying to chew my calves. Then I find him. I find the office. I go in. We sit outside under the shade of what was it? I think it was a fig tree. He has a cane. He looks like, you know, Marlon Brando before he dies in the vegetable garden playing with his kid.
I'm looking for Don Corleone, was it?
Yeah, I'm looking if I'm sitting on some plastic paper. I'm like, maybe he's going to whack me here and they put you in the plastic. I don't know if you remember the Lethal Weapon. He goes, why am I standing on plastic? And then we start talking and I said, we talk in Italian. And I said, after a long chat, I said, I'd like to buy the vineyard of Pinot. And he goes, which one? Because he had a few of them. I said, the one here in my case. He says, I don't think that's a good idea. I said, why? He goes, because you're young. You're Italian. You're a good guy. They're going to rob you blind. You're going to go home with your tail between your legs with no money, and it's going to be a disaster for you. I'm like, fair enough. How about renting it then? Renting it to me for 2 years. And then if you're not worried about me by then, maybe you can sell it to me. So we handshook.
Handshook deal.
Old style. We made the wine the first 2 years at Noemia in vat number 7. It was an experiment. 1,370 bottles, 1,330 bottles, first vintage. 7 vintage, 2,770 bottles. And then a lot of things start happening, a lot of weird things. I'm in Vegas for a wine show, phone rings. A guy says, I'm here standing in front of your wine and I want to buy it all. It's magic. And so I thought it was a joke. I hang up the phone immediately. I go to the metal detector. He keeps on ringing. I keep hanging up. And then the guy goes, stop. So he was a distributor from Argentina. They wanted to buy the whole wine. You know, I wasn't expecting this.
Tell us a little bit about the environment where you're making wine. You've told us a little bit about it, about the diurnal variation, the winds, which is why you grow those poplar trees. Just tell us a little bit about the soil type and where you are in the world. I mean, which bit of Patagonia are you in? Because Patagonia is huge, right?
But first of all, we're in the Garden of Eden. And I say this with the utmost seriousness. I believe these words. Why? I've been around the block. I farmed in Tuscany. I farmed in many different places. I witnessed farming. The microclimatic condition and the soil composition here are fairly unique. So let's talk about above ground first, climate. We have incredible luminosity that gives us a perfect ripening of the grapes. So ripening is not an issue. We have a constant wind that removes all the pests, disease, and bacteria and dries the cultivation if it rains. Fantastic. Prevents oidium and other things. Then we have cold nights because there is no pollution. And so the cold nights really are helping to develop the finer, delicate aromatics of Pinot. Lastly, we have four very distinctive seasons. And we have no challenges except for spring frost. Then let's talk below ground soil composition. Our main elements is silt, sand, a little bit of clay, and then pretty much everywhere between 1 meter to 1.5 meters, we have riverbeds, what French people call grave. They're round and small in shape, and they're covered with white material, which is calcareous matter. So our soil composition, it's really conducive to make the wine that we want to do. This is where we won the lottery, Tim. This is where it's pure luck, okay? Because we're very lucky. We're very unlucky, but we're very lucky. And so if luck is not at the rendezvous, you can be doing whatever you want to do right and still it's not going to happen.
Yeah, so the climate's good and the soils are great, yeah, for making the styles of wine you want to make.
Wait. And then wait a second. Oh, you have ungrafted vineyards of Pinot Marsal selection that have been here for 130 years. So the mutation has occurred already. They've adapted and we just have bettered their ecosystem around them and now they're thriving. Cover crop. We planted something like 30,000 trees, poplar trees to protect the vineyards from the wind. We shrink the size of the parcels. And then with Pedro Parra's reading, we knew exactly where all the minerals are because we did the electrical conductivity of the soils. And so we know where the minerals are and we know at what depth they are. And so we can go back and do some soil work and allow the root system that are not within those minerals to go a little bit deeper and find this incredible supermarket of nutrients and silt.
And can you tell us about the way you farm? You once said to me, I love this quote, you said, Chakra is not a winery, it's a farm that happens to make wine. Just tell us about your approach to organics and biodynamics.
Yeah, I mean, look, what we're doing as farmers, it's so unnatural. It's crazy. We do a high-density plantation, which is the most silly things. And the only reason we do it like this is for monetary reason. Because sadly, you know, everything has been twisted around and now it's all about money. And so you need to put plants 1 meter from the other so that you can go in with the tractor and machinery and rah, rah, rah. But they're miserable. They're miserable. Imagine putting that amount of individuals in one single room. Nobody would having a good time. And so, you know, we decided to appease this miserable life of them by stop spraying. I mean, I don't think the guy before us sprayed a lot because it's costly and here they're so poor. And we decided to approach it with an organic and biodynamic farming, which is holistic. Most people misinterpret, I think, the holistic because, you know, whatever reason. And so we've intervened in a very sensible way without the use of chemical components. We plow by hand. We use two types of cover crop for the winter and the summer, and we have extended the canopy to 1 square meter. So all our values are much more in line, whether it's pH, acidity. Because then the goal, what's the goal, Tim? The goal is to make sure that you're preparing an athlete for the Olympics, not that you make him suffer. A lot of people say the plant has to suffer. Well, the plant should not have an obscene amount of food, but you have to find the right balance. And I don't believe the right balance is within suffering, because if you're suffering, you don't have natural reserves in the plant. And when this plant experiences some hard times, it doesn't have those reserves, the reserves that are naturally built in there to be able to go to the extra mile and withstand that drought or that heat. Or that cold.
I'm glad you've said that, because I think you hear that a lot, don't you? It's a very French thing. Oh, you know, the vine must suffer. But I agree with you. Why must the vine suffer? You don't want to overindulge the vine, but there's nothing wrong with having a balanced vine, right?
No, but also I constantly draw a parallel because I don't know much. I constantly think about humans. And I'm asking you, Tim, do you like to suffer?
No.
Do you?
No.
You know, I my big revelation here was 10 years ago. I fell from a wine vat. I have 13 fractures. I went in a wheelchair for 8 months. And once I started rehabbing, my rehab was the most painful thing ever. And so I thought maybe there is other ways. And so I think that organic and biodynamic farming are just the same language as nature as it is. They're not petrochemicals. So they're really adapted and they work very, very well. You have to be slightly more intuitive. You have to be more observational. You need to have a good team that is motivated. They also need to develop a pair of trained eyes. Luckily, we're so far from everywhere that we need to do all of our biodynamic preparation in-house. Mm-hmm. And we do our own compost here. So chakra is 100% traceability. We monitor absolutely everything because we're trying to codify what we're doing in an effort to share them with everyone, in an effort to show everyone step by step what we do. By the way, we're not the only ones. We're not doing anything special or amazing or new. There is nothing that is innovative about chakra. We just work really, really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And we reverted to 100 years to look at what were those practices and how can we follow those practices? So no mechanization, no herbicides, no pesticides, you know, none of that kind. Why? It's a selfish reason. Why is a selfish reason? Because I think that if I don't put antibiotics in my body, I don't have to spend a ton of money with probiotics to reset the damage of the antibiotics. So if I don't do fungicides, pesticides, and everything else, I don't have to then go in with a heavy hand with other product to offset that. So that is already, boom, out goes the chemicals. And then in comes the natural homeopathic products. And they seem, this plant seems to respond well. And for a longer period of time. But here's what nobody really wants to talk about it. The fact, if you have a good soil, okay, all of this is provided that you have a good vineyard, the right soil composition and a good climate. Okay, so the set has to be there. But by following these practices, the soil get decontaminated, the nutrients come back in, and you activate a lot of different things in the soils. Now, these are through the channel of the root system are transferred to the grapes. Hmm. What does it do to the grapes? They're more balanced. They taste
which is perfect for the style of Pinot you make, right? Or styles of Pinot. I want to bring you back to Pinot quickly, can I? Because how many different Pinots do you make? I mean, how many of them are vineyard based as it were, and how many of them are blends of vineyards or parcels?
They're all except one. Parcel single vineyard wines. But, you know, Tim, again, we blend also the single vineyard wines because one plot, one vat, 20 barrels. Of the 20 barrels that come from the same vat and from the same plot, they all have a different identity. So some of those barrels will be inevitably declassified and placed in Barda.
And Barda is almost like your blended wine, isn't it? Your blended Pinot.
Yeah, I mean, Barda is a real old style perception second label. It's the difference at Chakra is that these vineyards are so old that for us, the second label, which is Barda, comes from a vineyard that is 25 years old. And that's typically the standard age for the vineyards in Europe. Also because when they're not ungrafted, the vineyards last less, as you know. And so Barda received the classification of the other grapes and has its own vineyard that is planted on a sandy soil, while the other wines are all single vineyard wines. And what distinguishes them is the age of the vineyard, the soil composition, and there is a third element that all Chakra wines are field blends, Tim. You know, in those days, everything was field blend. So I find few plants of Trousseau, a couple of plants of Cabernet Franc, and we leave them there. And whenever we reproduce every year, we prepare up to 30,000 plants, new vines through our nursery. We reproduce them as a unit. The idea is to preserve this biodiversity within the same family. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I should do. Yeah. And you also make.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say you also make a Malbec, but you also used to make a Merlot, and then you grafted the Merlot over to Chardonnay, and you're now making a pair of amazing Chardonnays. I think two of the best Chardonnays in South America, with none other than Mr. Jean-Marc Rouleau. Tell us how you met Jean-Marc and how you made those wines.
Well, Jean-Marc has been a friend. I had the privilege to work for my family company for 25 years. That brought me to many markets, in particular the American one. This was over 25 years ago. I got to meet, this was 35 years ago. I got to meet a lot of sommelier that I was going to, that I met at wine tasting for Sassicaia, and we became friends. And then the fact that I was Italian and I spoke French. So I guess for my friend, being Italian means that you're a good driver, the little that he knew. Then we started traveling
to France. Fast driver.
And yeah, Raj was buying for Michael Mina in those days.
It's this a is Raj Pa, the sommelier, yeah? And now winemaker.
Yeah, okay. Now he's a winemaker. Ned Benedict, which was my best friend, who sadly passed a few years ago, was buying for, in those days, a retailer in Jersey called Zaki's. I think Ned was buying like $10 million of Burgundy a year. And then there were other people coming in and out because a lot of these U.S. sommeliers were traveling the U.S. So you bump into Richard Betts, which was the sommelier of the Little Nell in Aspen, and other young characters. You know, the great thing about these American sommeliers is that they're so smart and they travel and they want to go and they gather information and they taste. And it's great for the industry. It's great for them. It's great for everyone. So in these trips, we drank a lot, we ate a lot, and we visited a lot of wineries. Jean-Marc was one of them. And over the course of the years, these trips, then we expanded to Burgundy, into Champagne, Chablis, but also Jura and other regions. And so we became friends and we started vacationing together. And one evening I was having dinner at Guillaume d'Angeville house in Volnay. His wife, Pauline, was sitting to my left and Jean-Marc was sitting in front. There was a bunch of sommeliers from New York. I remember Thomas, who started to play the piano, and Raj was there, and it was fun. Pauline says, where have you been? I said, tell me about your trips. I heard you went to Champagne. I said, yeah, I went to Champagne and Chablis, and we met this young couple, and they say, why don't we come and make Chardonnay for you in Patagonia? Because it's winter, it's cold here, and we could do this project together, it would be great. And because these guys were the disciples of the Vissat, of course, it perked my interest. And I said, don't you think this is great? And Jean-Marc says to me, he goes like, what? You're going to ask some people from Chablis, you're not asking me? I mean, they're not even your friends. I mean, you know.
You've got Jean-Marc Rouleau to make your Chardonnay.
I never developed the swagger, the audacity of the arrogance to ask Jean-Marc to come and make Chardonnay here. So the fact that he asked made me feel so happy, because Jean-Marc is the big brother that everyone wished they had. He's the most elegant man I know. Mm-hmm. But it's much more than that. I talk about individual because, you know, everybody knows that he's an amazing winemaker, but I don't know if everybody knows him. So it's such a privilege because this is a life story. It's not a winemaking story. This is a life story because Jean-Marc is a friend. It's the story of two families coming together in Patagonia. He makes the Chardonnay. We make the Reds. And we're together in this adventure. So yeah, he makes two Chardonnays.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah. Now I believe you divide your time, obviously, between Argentina. I think you spend a lot of time in Ibiza, don't you? And the States. I just wonder, would you ever move back to Italy? Could you see yourself running Sassicaia if you were asked?
Listen, never say never. Sassicaia today belongs to a family. I am one of the five owners of the business. Never say never. Everything is possible. My life is real about Chakra nowadays. We have a lot of work that we're doing and that we're going to keep doing. It's incredibly excited. It's a nimble, young company with a lot of very motivated, smart people. And it's such a privilege to have such a great team. It's difficult to give this up. They're becoming like my family every day more and more. They tolerate me, most importantly. That is very difficult. They put up with all my crap. My neurosis is quite high. So, you know, all those details that are irrelevant, I'm obsessive about it. So working with me, it's at times a little bit more challenging, but really it's so much fun. A wine critic, I want to spin the beans. I don't want to say who it is, but a very important wine critic says Chakra is today what Sassicaia was in 85. I don't know, maybe because we won, you know, with James Suckling, we won best wine in the world. We got 100 points. We got all these scores. We got named best new winery in the world. So maybe he was doing parallels in terms of what we're winning. I don't know, but it's freedom. here's complete freedom. And there's a lot of research and development we're doing. I'm a founder, so I can take a lot of risk. And since the inception, Chakra has taken the decision to reinvest 100% of the benefits in the company without ever distributing a dividend. So we want this company to be monetized, to be have enough financial resources to really never have to cut corners in the wines. Sometime if one of our wine has bread, there will be a no release. Okay. So we take draconian measures sometime because we can, but also we are so frugal in our behavior, and also we are very restrained, you know, so never give up to what is a capitalistic model that might be very rewarding in the short term, but in the long term.
But not really, in the long term.
We're lifers, you know, Tim.
I like that. It's, well, you're a lifer, and I love your quote. You say it's complete freedom. Piero, thank you so much for sharing this incredible vision and this incredible place with us in the podcast. And I hope to see you very soon, either down there or over here, or possibly in Italy.
Down here for sure. I will make sure of that.
It sounds great.
Tim, thank you for your time. It was great seeing you.
Thank you, man.
Well, I think we only scratched the surface there. So if you want to know more about Bodega Chakra's wines, catch up with the Instagram tasting I recorded with Piero. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the globe-trotting Bordeaux winemaker, François Lurton. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles, and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.